From the Wall Street Journal, this is Instant Message. I'm David Pierce. This week on the show, Google gets big into the gaming industry, but not by building a console, or so far having very many games to play. We'll get into that. And later on, my chat with Jeff Chapin, a co-founder at Casper, about whether technology or even a really good mattress can actually help you get a better night's sleep, and whether we really know anything about what a good night's sleep is at all. But first, Apple launched like 65 new things this week, and by the time you listen to this, there will probably be more. Who knows? Anyway, here with me, as always, to talk about all of this, my fellow tech columnists, Joanna Stern and Christopher Mims. Hi, friends.
Hello.
Hey, friends.
You both sound so good. This is so exciting.
I just did a different hello this week. I'm just playing around with different hellos.
I like it. So, okay, so Apple, this was like the weird week of Apple launches. And this is a very un-Apple thing. We've been dealing with new Apple products for a long time.
Dribbling it out.
Mims, can you give us the list? Do you have it off the top of your head? What's all the new stuff?
I have the memory of a goldfish. So all I remember is the last one is new AirPods, new chip. Supposedly they connect with your devices faster and they have longer battery life and they can do wireless charging. Still no noise canceling. And, you know, hooray, it's an incremental upgrade.
And the day before that, what happened the day before that?
There was an iPad mini. Everybody knows there's an iPad mini with the latest chip.
Well, actually, that was the day before that, before that.
Oh, dang. What am I missing?
So there were 3 days. The AirPods were on Wednesday. Yep. What happened on Tuesday?
It's large, expensive, sits on your desk.
Mm-hmm. It's the new iMac?
Yes.
There it is.
Ding, ding. Can we get a sound effect?
That's why I don't know, because I could 100%. Not care less 100% about a monitor that you can't replace.
Well,
and it was basically like, it was just a spec upgrade to the existing iMac, which means you can now spend an outrageous amount of money to get like 256 gigs of RAM. It's basically a computer no reasonable human needs, but if you want it, you know, hell yeah.
And then what happened
on
Monday?
It made 8 people really excited. Monday was my favorite day, personally. Monday was new iPads. There was
David,
the new iPad mini.
Lover of the iPad.
Which is like 4 or 5 years old now. It had been forever since they upgraded the iPad mini. So there's a new iPad mini. Looks the same. New stuff on the inside. And a new iPad Air, which is $500. The mini's $400. And basically, same deal.
What is the difference between the $350 iPad and the $500 iPad Air?
Oh, man. I've spent the whole week trying to suss out the answer to this question.
Read David's
answer
column.
The answer is my column, but the short version of the answer is you get a faster processor and a slightly better version of just about everything. The screen's a little better, it's built a little nicer, it's a little bigger, and it's more expensive. And that's like become the weird thing about the iPad now is there's 5 of them and they're all different prices. It's a very un-Steve Jobs way of thinking about an Apple product where like before it was just the iPad. There was the one, and then they made a smaller one for people who wanted a smaller one, and then they made a bigger one for people who wanted a bigger one, and now we're just down this road of there's eventually going to be 45 different SKUs of the iPad for every imaginable use, and it'll be like buying a laptop or a television. It's just getting really messy, but the biggest difference between all of them now is basically size and price. And I love the mini. That's my broad note is the mini is still my favorite iPad. It rules.
I reviewed the mini this morning.
The best iPad or your favorite?
It's just the right size. Like people always say, "Oh, it's, you know, basically the same size as your phone," but it's not. It's at least twice the size of your phone. And it's just this perfect mix of I can hold it in one hand, so it's great for reading in bed or, you know, standing on the subway reading or watching a movie or whatever. Big enough that I can sort of put on a plain tray table and feasibly watch a movie. Battery's really long. It now supports the Apple Pencil. I don't need more screen size because I don't really draw or care that much about gigantic screens for
videos.
And
it's not a laptop replacement for you because all the iPads I see in the wild are paired with a keyboard. People are straight up using it as a laptop replacement. And anytime I ask about this on Twitter, I get so many responses, people raving about how it is their primary, sometimes their sole device. It's really remarkable how many people have realized Tim Cook's vision.
Yeah, it's really true. And I feel like the mix of having a computer either at work or at home for the sort of mix of things you can't yet do on an iPad, whether you're dealing with flash drives or old apps or whatever, having that sort of in a pinch, but then being able to use an iPad for a lot of your computing is actually a very cool thing. And I feel like I've heard from a lot of people also who are doing that same thing. But then, I don't know, I just keep going back to a laptop. There's just something nice about the feeling that, like, this can do everything and I understand it, that feels nice and familiar to me.
Sure, but I do love, I mean, iPad. Somebody we know wrote a column about how your phone is your best computer. Which, by the way,
that person must
I made a single change to my lifestyle. I bought one of those cases with a flip-out stand, just realized that my existing external portable keyboard is perfectly fine for my phone, and am now also living that life. I really am living the, like, phone as computer life for some percentage of my work life.
It's great. And the most important accessory to any phone is a kickstand. I believe this wholeheartedly.
I thought it's a pop socket.
It's a pop socket, but a pop socket is also a kickstand. So I'm still...
It's not. Right. Brand. I'm not
done with the pop socket.
Pop socket
fit in
TM. It's a brand.
It's like it's Kleenex now.
Right.
But so, okay, wait, Joanna, I want you to explain why Apple didn't launch the only thing you really wanted this week. And who knows, the week's not over. By the time this goes out, it's very possible Apple will have launched it, because it has.
Well, the reason I'm not talking that much is, like, I've been living in a constant state of anxiety that in any second Apple could announce AirPower. It could happen right now. Like, it could happen within this podcast time. We don't know when AirPower is going to come. It's very hard to live my life this way, and I don't think it's going to. I don't know. I go back and forth, like, every other second. Is it going to come this week? Is it going to come next week?
Set up for a tweet from Tim Cook?
I don't have that set up. If you mean in case he tweets another iPad mini image on his iPad mini?
It's so good. It's like one of the greatest meme formats I've ever seen. That thing of Tim Cook holding an iPad mini in one hand and a pencil in the other hand, and then just a blank white screen. There's just a lot of runway to what you can put on that screen. Wait, but Joanna, explain the chaos around AirPower, because I feel like for people who don't follow this as closely as we do, they're either asking, what is AirPower, or why are you so excited about a charger? So explain the story of AirPower.
So everyone should close their eyes and think back long ago to when the iPhone X was announced in 2005, and which was really just 2 years ago. And Apple announced that not only was this phone going to have wireless charging, but they were going to make a wireless charger of their own called AirPower. And not only was it going to charge the new iPhone X, but it was going to also charge all your other iOS-like gadgets. Or basically, it was also the AirPods, and it would also be your Apple Watch. Am I leaving anything out? It doesn't charge an iPad.
Nope, I think that's right.
Okay, so it charges those three gadgets all simultaneously, wirelessly. Fast forward, they were supposed to release this in 2018. That was, like, what they said. 2018, coming in 2018. Fast forward to the last day of 2018, and we still didn't have AirPower. In fact, my last tweet of 2018 was, I think I wrote something like, I think it's safe to say AirPower is not coming this year. Now we are in 2019, and this week, as Mims mentioned, the AirPods were announced on Wednesday with a wireless charging case, which makes you kind of think that maybe AirPower is coming, right? Like, what other wireless charger are you going to charge your AirPods with? I mean, it will work with any Qi-enabled wireless charger, but still, like, Apple's got to have AirPower, right? And our very own Trip Mickle even reported in his AirPod piece, and I'll quote from this, he says, the company earlier this year approved production of a wireless charging pad called AirPower, according to people familiar with the matter. It announced the product in late 2017. Is that what I said before?
Yeah.
Okay. I got it right? Okay.
Mm-hmm. 100%.
Yes. Thank you, Deepa. So yeah, the years are very confusing to me. So it just has made sense, right? Like, all the pieces are here now. It's time for AirPower. And given the 3 days of consecutive incremental announcements, it felt like maybe there'd be one more day of an incremental announcement. That would have been today, Thursday. We taped this podcast on Thursday. And then maybe it would be AirPower. But there's no AirPower yet. So I've just been living in this life of thinking that the AirPower is going to come at any second. We don't know what's going to happen.
Mims, are you as excited about Joanna's AirPower?
Oh, and I didn't even answer why I'm excited, by the way.
Yeah, why are you excited? Because I'm not.
There it is.
I mean, I'm like, whatever.
I have written the same column for, like, as long as our editor Wilson will let me write this column, which is that Apple has made charging its gadgets incredibly infuriating. It sells, with its gadgets, a low-powered charger, which you all have heard me rant about before on this podcast. It sells a single charger for every device, and all of them charge with different things, unless it's the AirPods with the lightning cable. But you still then, let's say you want to charge those at the same time, need to have a multi-USB charger. The beauty of AirPower is that you could throw all these things on. Like, if you watch the ad of what they had during that unveil of AirPower, You would just toss all your gadgets on this one sleek pad and they would charge. But
can I just interrupt and say how many watts though per gadget? Because if one of your complaints is that it's slow, my
understanding... It's going to be slow. It's going to be slow, but... I don't have a but. It's going to be slow. But here's the thing about wireless charging. It's okay that wireless charging is slow because during the day you're kind of trickle charging, right? You're trickle charging. It just sits there and you add a little power as you're going through the day and you're okay. I don't mind if wireless charging happens at night too because it's slow and I'm sleeping.
Yeah, I mean, and to me it feels like the future in the coolest way, where it's like now you come home, you take off your bag and you take whatever you have out of your pockets and you put it in a dish next to your door or on a shelf or somewhere. And having that also be your charger seems like the dream. So like I want to just come home and just shed everything. And then when I come back, it's all charged. And I feel like AirPower is the closest thing to that that exists now. And everything else is one charger that's like awkward to put your thing on, and they're expensive and weird and they only charge one thing at a time. And this was just... made it all easier, except it's now been a year and a half and it doesn't exist, and I'm no longer convinced it's ever going to.
Well, according to our colleague, Mr. Tripnickel, it's been ready for production. So they must have had, I mean, it's been reported that they had lots and lots of production and development delays and issues engineering this thing, and now it seems like it's ready. I mean,
possible.
I think
that this is going to come next week.
What do you want to bet? Lay odds. We're going to get the Joni Ives special. We haven't seen him show up in any of their things in a while. You know, like, he's always on video. He's going to be like, it was in order to create this perfect charging experience, we had to visit the Himalayas, and you know.
We need to record that and play that on every podcast right there. That one more time.
Beautiful. The Himalayas.
That was beautiful.
We use only the finest ingredients.
Replay.
The Himalayas.
Replay. I mean, I do think that the strategy of just dropping AirPower in a tweet would have been a little bit weird. But like Apple seems to be on this like funny self-aware kick. So like, you know, Tim Cook is drawing AirPods on his, you know, iPad mini with a pencil, and he's got a new AirPod in his ear.
By the way, you guys know why this took so long, right? It is hard as the dickens because just the physics of it. So this was something that came up when I was talking to people for a piece a long time ago about how you do like over the air charging. But one of the problems with Qi charging is that let's say the device is like, let's say instead of putting it on the pad perfectly aligned, you just slap it on there in your mythical bowl, charging bowl, or it's like 90 degrees off. If you are out of alignment with like the circuitry of the thing that's supposed to couple with it to transmit power, it can make it so that it's transmitting a fraction of the power that it would transmit under optimal conditions. So my theory is that to keep this like a casual, just put it on the pad type of thing, they had to put an insane amount of engineering into it, because the alternative is you have to put it, you know, within some like outline on the pad, and it has to be exactly aligned and it has to be perfect and it won't charge through a case and all the rest, because it just turns out that's really, really hard to transmit power even over a short distance.
And also, like, this was three different devices that you have to be able to like put anywhere on the pad. They didn't say, like, when they marketed this thing, you have to put your iPhone here and you have to put your AirPods here and you have to put your watch here. Like, it's that in the images, like, it was just like, toss it on here, it's gonna work.
There's some really intense technology in this is the bottom line, and the teardowns are gonna be really fun and interesting for wireless power geeks.
Good luck to everyone else.
Yeah, maybe it's coming on Monday.
The other big gadget news this week was at a conference that actually happened this week, the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco, and that's where Google announced a new gaming service called Stadia. Stadia is not a console, really. It's not like an Xbox or a PlayStation. It's really not any hardware at all other than a controller. You actually play games by streaming them directly from the cloud. So all the power and computing lives in Google's data centers, and you can game on virtually any screen you can find. Google's announcement, like a lot of announcements now, didn't have a lot of detail, but it still seems like kind of a big deal. So Sarah Needleman, our reporter on The Beat, wrote a story about Stadia after the announcement this week. She's going to tell us more about what Google's up to. And according to the email she just sent me, she's outside the studio in New York knocking right now. Joanna, can you go let her in?
Sure. Sound effect. I just did it for you.
That was beautiful.
She's right here, guys, though.
Sarah, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
So explain to us what Google is doing in gaming. Google's like not ordinarily what you would think of as a gaming company, even though it runs Android, which has lots of games, but now is making a big and very sort of googly move into like the high-end gaming universe. Can you explain sort of what Stadia actually is?
Sure. It's a service that lets you stream video games from the cloud, and you don't need any pricey hardware. So you don't need a console, for example. And it's sort of like Netflix or Hulu. You're not downloading games and you're not inserting a disc into anything. You're streaming the games straight from the cloud.
And they made this big noise out of integrating it with YouTube in a way that I don't totally understand. Because there's like YouTube is, it's not like Twitch popular, but it's a relatively popular place where people watch other people play video games or watch trailers or learn how to beat levels. But Google's trying to figure out how to integrate all of that with actually playing games, right?
Right. So if from what we've seen, they didn't provide too much detail, but if you're watching a video of a game, some sort of video about a game, or maybe it's just a live stream of a game, there will be some sort of button or you click and it will actually give you the opportunity to go ahead and buy that game in some way, shape, or form and begin playing it. So if you're using your computer or if you're using your TV, which you would need a Chromecast, or your phone, and you're watching YouTube, there'll be some way to click onto a video of a game, say it's God of War, whatever. I don't know which games they're going to have yet because they didn't announce that, but you would be able to jump into that game. And even at the exact point, supposedly, that the person playing it on YouTube would be at. It's kind of hard to imagine. It's pretty wild.
So, quick question. Aren't there other streaming game services? Don't they have a lot of competition?
Yeah. I wouldn't say a lot. There are a couple out there, but they're not as sophisticated as what Google at least is claiming to be able to offer. So, for example, on PlayStation, there has been a streaming service for a couple of years now, but it's only catalog games. You don't have the modern, new, fancy-schmancy Mambo Jumbo multiplayer games. Same for GeForce Now, which is from NVIDIA. They offer some cloud gaming, and it is with some newer titles, but even they have acknowledged that the quality is not up to, it's not on par with what you would get from a console or a gaming PC. And so they did say that if you're playing esports, meaning competitively, that service would not be appropriate because in esports, even a half second delay in the piping would be a problem for you. And they have not solved that. And what Google is claiming is that they have solved it, that you would theoretically be able to play any video game, even the really fast-paced ones that have hundreds of players over the internet without even a half second delay. Whether that
over
actually
Wi-Fi
is true.
In my home.
Yeah, well, we haven't yet seen it, but that is what they're claiming to be the case, which is pretty amazing.
Do you believe what? Google? Is there any evidence that that's true?
Do you believe
true?
It?
Well, they did do a test last fall with Ubisoft's Assassin's Creed. Now, it was a single player game. It wasn't like a Fortnite or something. But when you did stream it, it was seamless. It really look like you would think you were playing it on a console or a gaming PC, and you would have no idea.
You press the button, and the latency is so low that the response is instantaneous or faster than
exactly.
You can tell.
They had this in Silicon Valley, guys. The show, Hulu. They got Hulu's technology, and this is how it works now.
And so I want to see a game like Fortnite or Apex Legends or Call of Duty. I'm just curious to see how that will work.
What do they have any hardware like controllers or VR heads?
They do have a controller that's specially made for Stadia, and it has some neat bells and whistles on it. Like, there's a button you can press if you're stuck, and the Google Assistant will come up and help you figure out how to get ahead in whatever game you're playing, supposedly.
Oh, not like a technical error, but like you're stuck in the game.
Like, I can't beat this boss, someone help me. And they'll probably, what they implied was that they would take you to a video on YouTube that gives you a tutorial on how to do what other people have spent hours searching for to figure out, apparently in a matter of seconds. But they also said that it would be compatible with existing controllers, probably maybe the Xbox controller. So that is the only, and if you're playing it on a PC or a laptop, you wouldn't need any controller, you just need your mouse button. And if you're playing on your TV, you do need hardware, but it would just be the Chromecast Ultra, and those are not very expensive, and it's and a controller.
And what's the pricing structure? You pay for the service, you pay for the games.
That is a good question. If only Google would have told us.
They didn't say anything.
They did not say anything.
Did they say anything about the back end? Because I'm just thinking about the latency here, and it just seems like, okay, if they're making this work and Sony can't, the difference has got to be Google's distributed cloud infrastructure.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what gives that's the only reason I think Google is going into this, and why we know Microsoft is going into it too, and Amazon is rumored to be stepping in, because they are well suited to handle this sort of technology. Google did give some insight into some techie stuff. They said that games will run it up to 4K resolutions with HDR at 60 frames a second, and they're saying that's quality and speed that even the most hardcore gamer should be satisfied with. And they also talked about partnering with AMD to create some sort of chip that would, a GPU graphics processing unit for Stadia that would be completely customized for cloud gaming.
I wrote about a startup like a year ago that was trying to do the same thing. It was this company called Shadow, and their whole thing was they're able to stream basically a whole Windows PC with the idea that you would mostly use it for PC gaming, but you can do it on any device that runs a Shadow app, which was most of them. And the thing that they said that was interesting that has stuck with me since then was basically that because they're doing all of it in the cloud, the only thing they're uploading is your button presses, and the only thing they're downloading is video. And we have infrastructure to do all of those things very quickly now. So as long as you have even a decent connection and there are servers close by, which Google has better than anybody at this point, is they're able to do this stuff relatively easily. And they made it sound like as long as there's enough processing power in the place itself, that getting it to and from you is not as complicated as it might seem, which I thought was really interesting.
I think that is probably true. And with the, the spread of data centers and maybe 5G and all this stuff, that we'll see other services can provide that tech. But what the challenge that Shadow probably has and others is getting the content. And Google has the deep wallet, so they're probably in much better position than a startup to make arrangements with the publishers that would be satisfying to them. But they did not announce anything of that nature the other day. So we still don't know if they're going to have these AAA games. They did talk about building their own studio, and they have Jade Raymond, an alum from EA and also Ubisoft, to lead that initiative. But developing new content, a game from scratch, even if you have the greatest people, it can take years. And even then, there's no guarantee you're going to have a hit. So,
Sarah, in terms of the AAA games, I mean, doesn't this feel like the sort of the Spotify moment for gaming? So we're going from the iTunes world where you buy tracks, you buy games, you go to the Spotify world where it's all streamed. Like, isn't that potentially a huge threat to the bottom line of the AAA game studios?
Well, actually, no, I think it would be beneficial to any of the studios or publishers, because now they have an additional way of reaching people, especially people who have not wanted to plunk down $500 for a console. I mean, all these years you may have been like, I always want to play Call of Duty, but I'm not spending $500 on an Xbox. And now they don't have to do that. So it would potentially increase the market, which would be good for publishers. Additionally, if Google offers publishers a larger cut, I mean, they have to strike deals. They do get part of the revenue. So if Google says, hey, well, instead of giving you the traditional 70-30 split where we take 30, maybe we'll only take 20. And then that could pressure Sony with PlayStation and Microsoft to lower their rates to be more competitive. And so, or it's possible the publisher will say, hey, we're not paying Google as much as we pay Sony and Microsoft. So for consumers, instead of charging you $60 for a game, if you buy it through Google, it'll only be $50. I mean, I'm just making up these numbers, but this could only be potentially beneficial to, I think, the publishers and possibly consumers.
Well, also, it's $60 for a game, but now I can play it on my laptop, on my TV, on my phone.
Exactly. And you could start on your TV at home, then you hop on the bus, you play it on your phone, and you get to work and maybe play it on your laptop if your employer's so nice to let you do that.
It's like a Nintendo Switch, but it's just the hardware I already have.
Yeah, you can game 24/7.
Yeah. And I mean, then that goes back to the same point, right? Is that it's the Switch to me is the perfect example of it being all about the games. Like, the Switch itself is not particularly impressive hardware, but it had Zelda and it had Mario, so nobody cares. And you play those games and they're awesome, and it doesn't really matter what you're playing them on. So if in theory you can get like whatever device you want plus whatever game you want, you're in the greatest shape ever. But there's a long history of there's a long history of nobody else being able to get those games.
Right. I mean, exclusivity is a big deal. Like, the reason Xbox 360 and the newer one have done so well is because Halo is a big draw for that. And people right. like the PlayStation 4 because of God of War or Spider-Man or, you know, there are certain titles that you can only get on these specific platforms. And certainly that's why Google's starting its own studio with the hope that they'll come out with some amazing game that people will say, well, I have to get, you know, I have to join Stadia, whether it's a subscription or whatever it is. If they can only get it through Stadia, that may be a huge draw.
There were no details on when. There are no details on how much it's going to cost. There were no details on the price, like, or the even the games it's going to have. So is that, are they announcing it now basically to say, like, please come give us games so that there's something to do when this actually launches?
I mean, I have to imagine Google has been reaching out to publishers and studios all this time. And this is, I mean, that we've known about this for a while already because of the tests they did last fall
right.
with Assassin's Creed. So I don't really think that. I think maybe they're getting ahead of the curve because E3, the big annual video game conference, is happening in June. So this is an opportunity for them to plant their flag with more details than we've gotten before ahead of what we presume will be a big announcement from Microsoft. So that may be it. And they'll probably start rolling it out in small batches and just getting the word out that this is happening.
I'm not a gamer, which you guys can probably tell by this conversation. But one thing that I always think is really interesting about what happens in the gaming community or what happens with gaming technology is like it heads down to consumers in different ways in a couple of years' time, right? So everything from like even PC gaming, right? Like PCs started to be really big thing with gamers and became much more of a popular thing with regular consumers. Do we think this type of technology is headed in that same direction? Like is this type of everything in the cloud, things that you wouldn't even imagine that need to be in a cloud, our operating systems, our emails, everything like that's already there, right? A lot of our services are already there, but like that fundamentally nothing has to be on the device. Is that where we're going, do you think?
I think so, because this has been like the holy grail for years. I mean, we're going back a decade where different startups have been chasing this technology. There was a company called OnLive that had they had done that, and they ran into some troubles along the way. I think a lot of it had to do with the relationships with publishers, not wanting to give up that the percentage that they were getting through other means. Just like you said, all this stuff going in the cloud, it's only inevitable that gaming will go there too. It's just been a slower evolution because the technology is so much more difficult mm-hmm. to make it work. But this has been something that companies have been working for a while, and it just makes sense. Everything else has gone that way. And we've already seen very few people buy games on discs anymore. Everybody's doing digital downloads. And so it's just going in that direction.
Okay, so we should move on here. But Sarah, before we let you go, tell us about Harry Potter. This is all I want to know about in the whole world. And you wrote a story about Niantic's Harry Potter game. Okay, he's a wizard.
Okay,
he's a star.
So what's interesting about this game is that it's set in the hot Harry Potter universe. And one of the problems that its predecessor...
And this we should just say, sorry, not to interrupt. But we should say this is Niantic's follow-up to Pokemon Go. Right. It's like augmented reality gaming on your phone.
Exactly. So one of the problems Pokemon Go had is that many players were inclined to turn the AR off because it made it actually a little bit more cumbersome to catch the Pokemon, the monsters. And so it was a little bit wonky, like the digital image wouldn't stand still. It wouldn't be firmly planted. What the folks at Niantic have told me is that the technology has matured and it's much better now. And so the hope is that people will give it another try with Wizards Unite, the new game, because they'll be able to do things that they couldn't do before. And it'll just be more immersive because the werewolf staring at you through your phone will actually look like it's a real werewolf and he's standing there. And you could take a selfie with him and you can look all 360 degrees around him. And that's not something you could do with Go. And so... it's important for at least for the AR community to show that this application can actually be popular and not be something that's turned off.
Have you gotten to play it yet?
No, I have not.
When's it coming out?
That is a good question. If they would only tell us. They said sometime this year. And Pokemon Go, if you remember, came out in July of 2016. I would imagine they want to go for the warm weather because right now to go outside, hunting for spells or mm-hmm. potions or whatever, it's not, at least here in New York, it's pretty miserable. So my guess is they're going to wait for the weather to be a little bit warmer.
It's going to be nice next week.
Maybe next week is the day.
I doubt it.
I doubt it too.
Let me know so I can not leave my house.
All right. Awesome. Thank you, Sarah.
My pleasure.
Okay. Coming up. My interview with Jeff Chapin, the co-founder and chief product officer at Casper, about whether technology can actually help us get a better night's sleep.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Welcome back. So I've had this long fascination with sleep gadgets. There are tons of them. They promise to track your sleep or help you sleep better or wake you up at exactly the perfect moment so you'll just feel fantastic. I've even tried a bunch of them, but nothing's ever really stuck. I just can't get used to wearing wristbands or even headbands while I sleep. But it's hard to imagine a company that has combined tech and sleep into more success and buzz than Casper. The company launched almost 5 years ago, and it made a big splash just by selling mattresses over the internet. Exciting. Now Casper makes sheets and dog beds and a lot more than just the one mattress. Most recently, it launched the Glow, this connected lamp that sits on your nightstand. It'll dim while you're reading in bed and then slowly brighten in the morning to wake you up. It's a bit different for a mattress company and also not the only gadget that Casper's working on. So a few days ago, I went to Casper's offices in San Francisco and sat down with Jeff Chapin, the company's co-founder and chief product officer, to talk about where Casper goes next. Around us, as we're sitting there, there are all these workstations with different kinds of foam. There was a machine that just presses down on mattresses over and over to test their firmness. There was a bunch of Glow prototypes and lots of other projects in different states of doneness. Casper's talked a lot over the years about how it's not just interested in being a bed and bedding company. It wants to be about everything to do with sleep. So Jeff and I started there. Other than with great stuff to sleep on and with and underneath, what else is there to making great sleep?
If you look at like the vernacular we use around sleep, like I fall asleep is probably the most common way to say it. If you think about what we're saying there, is it's a not very intentional thing. You just want it to happen and you want it to take over. And so there's a reason we use language like that, is because we expect sleep to be a natural thing that just happens and that we don't have to work for it. And so when you flip that and start to create products or experiences which are, you're essentially telling people that they have to be very intentional to get good sleep, or, you know, press go on this app to start tracking your sleep. Like
sleep time
is
now.
Not that. It's not a turn on right. thing. It just kind of comes over you. We know that. That's just how humans are. And so as a company, Casper's trying to figure out what can we do to help sleep take over when you want it to. Support the natural behaviors and habits you have, but do it in a way that is more conducive to getting good sleep. So as we look at like from 7 or 8 p.m. through 7 or 8 a.m., what's happening, you're gonna do all kinds of stuff to get ready for sleep. There's things that are, you might do like lock the front door. And you might not think about it this way, but by doing that, it's a step to make your house more secure or your apartment more secure. And so that lets you then, gives you permission to fall asleep, which is pretty much our most vulnerable state of being. You might dim the lights, you might turn down the television volume, you might go from a seating position on the couch to slump down into like a reclining position, which actually helps you start getting sleepy. There's all kinds of stuff, both physical, social, environmental, psychological, that's happening in that prep time. You know, as a company, we think there's some new products, new experiences that we can create that kind of fold into that.
Okay, so let's talk about what a better night's sleep looks like. Because as you were saying before, like one of the things I've started seeing a ton of is there's apps and sensors and whatever. They're like, we'll track your sleep and tell you about it and give you a score or data or whatever. And I can't find out if A, there's any medical basis to any of it or scientific basis to any of it, or B, if any of that matters. Like I'm pretty aware of how my sleep went last night. Like, is it,
yeah.
What's your sense of how we even quantify this stuff to make it better?
It's a great question. I think there's both qualitative and quantitative measurements. So your statement's dead accurate. Like, you don't need any measurement device to know if you had a good night's sleep or not. You wake up and you feel great, or you wake up and you feel crappy.
Right.
And sometimes you might know, like, you had 3 glasses of wine and so you feel fuzzy the next morning. And sometimes you're like, I don't know why I feel bad because I did everything right. That's the ultimate measurement, is do you feel energized? Does your body feel great? sweet? Does your head feel clear? That said, there are also like pretty legitimate quantitative measurements. I don't know, there's probably 10 or 12. It's, you know, how long does it take you to fall asleep? For the time in bed, how much of that, what percent of that time are you actually asleep versus awake? If you wake up in the middle of the night, how long does it take you to fall back asleep? Of the, say you are actually asleep for 8 hours, what percent of that was spent in light sleep versus deep sleep versus REM sleep? You know, all of those things are actually quantitative metrics, which can also be evaluated. They don't trump your feeling when you wake up, but they can help you give you insight into why you might feel one way or the other, or how certain behaviors or environmental factors might be impacting, you know, what are the probably the two most important parts of sleep, which are deep sleep and REM sleep.
But so how do you connect those two things, right? So there's, I took an hour to fall asleep, or I woke up and I was awake for 30 minutes,
yeah,
which is fine, like a useful thing to know, I guess, yeah, on some level, but it's only really useful to me if A, you can tell me why, and B, you can tell me what to do about it. Like, is there, do we have ways to connect those things?
No, not right now.
Okay.
I mean, like Casper's, for having a fairly large presence as a sleep company, we're conspicuously absent from having a sleep tracker. They're not that hard to make. And we don't have one because we haven't figured out how to close that loop yet. And so we generally think it's counterproductive to provide people sleep data without a means to improve their sleep, because it generally creates more anxiety and changes the mindset of sleep to something which is natural that you should take over and you fall into a switch that you can turn off and on and that you can measure. And so I would say it's not that we'll never do it, but we won't do it until we solve the problem of how do you make that information actionable and useful to people, and that we don't know how to do it yet.
But I guess the good news seems to be that we do know some things that affect how you sleep, like the one-to-one connection less so, the like cause and effect is maybe less so, but like there is some, like to the glow light, for instance, there is enough scientific evidence that the way the light works in your room affects how you sleep, right? Like we can actually operate on that assumption.
Yeah, for sure. So I think like...
Or maybe we can't, and maybe I'm wrong.
No,
I don't know.
We're fairly confident that, you know, with the glow light, with light, as one example of light, or with sound, or with scent, or with temperature, these things can have either a negative or a positive impact on sleep quality. Our chosen path is not to start with the measurement and providing data, but to start with modulating these environmental factors, and then on our own in the background, we can start studying quantitatively how they're helping.
But it also seems like, I mean, there is this kind of bigger thing going on now where it's like more people are thinking about things like, should I have my phone next to my bed when I sleep? And trying to figure out kind of what our relationship is supposed to be like with technology. And you're in this interesting place of like, you are very dedicated to the most intimate place in people's lives, which is their bed and their bedroom. Like do you have a stance on sort of how tech fits into your world?
Yeah, I mean, yes and no. I think as a company and just me personally, people are gonna live their lives the way they're gonna live them. And for the most part, it's a hard ask to have people bend their lives around sleep. And so,
even though it would objectively be better for everyone if we did a little more of that.
Yeah.
Which I think people instinctively know. Like if intellectually everyone knows they should get more sleep, I think.
Yeah.
Which is a weird thing.
Yeah, for sure. But it comes at a cost. Like if it means like, you know, you don't go out with friends and have a drink so you can get in bed earlier without any alcohol in your system, whatever it is, like it's all trade-offs and everyone's going to make their own decision. Our point of view has always been like, let's work within the lives that people want to live and help them to get the best sleep they can within these trade-offs of all these other decisions that they're making and priorities they're having. In terms of a phone in bed, like I think there's no question that you'd get better sleep if you didn't have that phone on your nightstand. And it's less about, you know, we don't have data on this, but like it's fairly clear. It's less about the light. Like you hear a lot about the light quality. You know, you got this bright light. It's actually not a lot of light that's coming off your phone. It's fairly low amplitude light. It's much more about the mental distraction that, like, you check a work email or you see some post on Twitter or it's on Instagram or Facebook and it gets your head churning and you get sucked into it, or it pulls you out of, like, the right headspace to fall asleep. So yeah, you'd be better off without it, but we certainly aren't. I think it'd be arrogant of us to, like, make a statement about people not doing that. Like, it's, there's a lot of that out there. It's all under the banner of sleep hygiene. There's like 10 or 20 rules of sleep hygiene. Obviously, you know, they're not sticky because people mostly don't follow them.
Is there tech out there that you've seen or tried that is actually cool or interesting? Like, I think one thing that seems endlessly compelling to me, to sort of limited effect, but I love the idea, is the stuff that will, like, the sleep trackers that will find the right spot in your sleep cycle to wake you up, where they're like, anytime between 30 minutes and zero before your alarm will wake you up at the perfect moment. I'm like, what a great idea. I'm not sure if I buy it, but, like, is there anything like that that actually seems compelling to you out there?
Let me think about that for a second. That specific example you gave is very hard because real-time tracking of sleep is, to my understanding, impossible. The best sleep trackers crunch the data the morning after and then give you a report back. So that real time, like, I know you're in this sleep state right now and I'm gonna do something. Right now, my understanding is that's not possible. So it makes me question, even though I love that, the same idea. I mean, years ago, I bought some of the early sleep trackers as a consumer before Casper, because I thought it was a great idea. It didn't really deliver. Now I understand more as to why it doesn't deliver. In terms of other stuff that's out there that's very compelling, it's a good question. Probably the most interesting thing I've seen, even though it's also a terrible customer experience, is Philips released this headband. It almost looks like this headgear people used to wear when they had braces.
Sure.
But it does. Philips as a company is very rigorous in their science, and so they put this thing through clinical trials, and they use different sound patterns to modulate your sleep quality. That thing is pretty interesting. Although to sleep with a headband is a quite odd thing. So I don't know, how can you get that sound benefit without the really awkward sleep experience? I don't know if that's solvable or if it has to have a headband. And then it's not a consumer product, but I know at MIT they have a whole sleep and dreams lab.
Oh, wow.
And they do some really weird things around controlling dreams and, you know, in really small sample sizes. And, you know, they're like, if you want to dream about grizzly bears, they can get you to dream about grizzly bears.
I do. That sounds right.
And so that stuff's cool. Like, yeah. As a company, we don't do anything with dreams, but as an idea, dreams are amazing.
Totally. And I feel like every 2 weeks on Kickstarter, some lucid dreaming thing is raising some amazing amount of money.
Yeah.
And it's always this is real now.
If it's doable, if you could reliably have lucid dreams or control your dreams, like, what an unreal experience to have.
By the way, if you ever bought one of those super fancy Casper dog beds, please email me and tell me about it. I'm so curious to know if it's as good as it looks or even close to worth the $125 price. Anyway, that's our show. Thanks to Jeff, Sarah, Joanna, and Christopher for being here. Thanks to Tanya Bustos, our producer, and Wilson Rothman, our editor. And thank you for listening. We have new episodes on Fridays, so make sure you subscribe to Instant Message on whatever podcast app you use. If you buy those new AirPods, by the way, I think you can just tell Siri you want to listen to us without even touching your phone. Give it a shot. As always, if you have feedback or ideas, email us at personaltech@wsj.com. We'll talk to you next week.